to us when we have biases in the workplace and in our lives socially? What are some of the typical types of bias? Age, right? Ageism. Weight, height. Interesting fact, do you know that over 70% of world leaders over the last, I think it's something like over the last 50 years, are over 6 foot tall. Same thing when you look at CEOs, companies. They're tall, predominantly. Gender, of course, we all know that. That's why we're in this room. Skin color. But we also have classified people according to their educational level, disability, their sexuality, their accents. I have to be careful because I'm in Texas, but do you know it's true that people automatically make assumptions about you based on your accent? So if I were to talk like a Valley girl from California, you know, like, chances are that you would have a certain bias against me. Southern accents hold the same thing. It's fascinating. Social status, of course, and job titles. So we automatically we're automatically assigning traits to anyone we subconsciously put into these groups. It saves us time. And here's something that's really interesting. In an average, say, Monday morning with technology, in 3 hours on a Monday morning, we get done more than most people would have gotten done 25 years ago in an entire week because of technology. So how does this affect our own biases? Well, we need to jump to conclusions more quickly, right? We need to make assumptions about people when they walk in our door, about things we're reading or not reading, about titles, about headlines, because we don't have the time to stop and consider and start from one, as they say in the film world, right? Imagine if you had to start over every time to reconsider something, an assumption that we have already developed in our life based on experience. So no matter how unbiased we believe that we are likely have some subconscious negative opinions about people who are unlike us. This is why Silicon Valley is so homogeneous, because the easiest thing to do is to hire people like you. I feel safe that way. I feel safe if I meet somebody who's a runner who went to UC Berkeley and who lives in Marin County. It's a slam dunk. My tendency, I want to hire them. That's why Silicon Valley looks the way it does. So how does unconscious bias affect us in the workplace? We talked about it with hiring. The average person in Silicon Valley, 25 to 35-year-old white male. What about promoting? This is something fascinating I learned recently. Self-promotions. So women and men are different, we know that. A lot of it's based on testosterone, but we're different beings. Here's an example of something that actually causes more bias in the workplace. We asked for self-evaluations. About 20 years ago, this was revolutionary. What a great idea. Let's have all of our employees evaluate themselves. By nature, women tend to be harder on themselves than men. So in self-evaluations, women are saying things like, well, I suppose I could have worked a little bit harder. I guess I could have had a few more people in that session than I had. I can see where I could work a little bit harder to get to the next level. I think I'm ready for that promotion. I'm not sure, but with the right support, I believe I could probably get there. Sound familiar? How does a man fill out a self-evaluation? No offense, I love men. Let's just start off by saying that. I'm a huge fan of men and of male allies. Just want to get that out of there, get disclaimer. But typically, a man would fill out a self-evaluation by saying, I feel like I absolutely exceeded the expectations. I am ready for the next step. Doesn't matter I've been there 3 months. I am ready for that promotion. I believe that I can handle the next step and I'm ready to go get it. Well, good for him, right? That's the kind of confidence we all need. But what happens is the self-evaluations get to the managers, and the managers are already biased. They can't help it. They already feel like, wow, Susie has a little bit of doubt about whether or not she's ready for the next level. And Steven, he's like, gonna nail it. So it's really hard to go back and give the same thought process to both candidates in that case. Interesting thought about whether or not to continue with self-evaluations. There's an interesting study that was done. I believe this was done at Carnegie Mellon. They took 10 qualifications for a job. A woman needs to have 8 to 10 of those qualifications before she'll even consider applying. A man will apply with confidence if he has 6 out of 10. Just a fundamental difference between us. Let me just touch on venture capital funding. Only 9% of venture capital companies have female partners. Less than 15% of seed funding, and this is a statistic from 2015, is allotted to female-founded companies. Why is that? I don't think it's direct or implicit bias. I don't believe it's the fact that they're sitting there saying, we are not going to let people of color and women in this door. We're not going to fund them. We don't believe in them. I think it's because, an example, they don't feel as comfortable. Venture capital is predominantly male. And when a woman walks in the door and says, I have this really neat idea about sort of like biking shorts, they're kind of like, but they're great, women are going to wear them, it's called Spanx. And the VCs are scratching their head going, didn't pantyhose go out in the 50s? Well, guess who's a billionaire right now? Sarah Blakely from Spanx. So it's an interesting example. Yeah, right on. She's amazing. So bias is a human condition. The question is, how do we mitigate bias so that it does not interfere with our ability to create diverse and productive businesses and inclusive workplace environments? And that is why I have an expert panel with me today to help answer all this. I'm going to start with introductions. On my far left in blue, your right, is Maury McInnes. She is the executive vice president and the first female provost at the University of Texas. Next to Maury is J. Newton Small. She is the Washington correspondent for Time magazine and the author of Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way America Works. I believe she's doing a book signing after this, so you have to go down there and get some. And the beautiful woman in red is China Widener. She's Deloitte's National Strategy and Operations Leader for Public Sector and the Diversity and Inclusion Leader. All right, hopefully my mic's working. Great. I'm going to start off by asking Jay a question. There seems to be this resurgence of energy around women's initiatives lately that talk about unconscious bias, and yet the feminist movement isn't new. So what makes this conversation about unconscious bias different?
Well, we just had an election where I think you saw, and which I covered for Time, and I think you saw a lot of questions and a lot of issues raised with the first, obviously, female candidate of either party, a lot of questions about how she was covered. And there was a lot of interesting conversations that we had in the media about covering her as women, but also covering her as a candidate, and whether or not younger women should support her. And so there's been a lot of questions about, why should younger women support her? What is the importance of electing the first female president? And young women, frankly, believe, they're the millennials or the first generation, and I'm a millennial, that believes that, they were born believing in the equality of the sexes. That's a hallmark of their generation, of my generation. And, they're the first generation born to working mothers. And so to them and to us, there's no question that there will be a female president in our lifetime. That's absolutely true. It's the question of why does it have to be Hillary? And arguably, she didn't fully make that case since she lost. But there has been this sort of question, I think, particularly amongst younger women, that I think is interesting about what is feminism? And what is, a lot of millennials call it womenism, right? It's not feminism, it's womenism, to be more inclusive for other sort of cultures and diverse opinions and thoughts. But I think we're actually at a really exciting moment right now where we see women reaching critical mass, which is what my book is about, in many areas of the workforce, particularly in all three branches of the government. And they're really beginning to have their voices heard in different ways. And so media is paying paying more and more and more attention to women and women's roles in the workforce, women's roles in office, and how we're treated and spoken about and listened to. And I think that's only going to increase as this happens. And I think we are, people don't realize this, but we're actually at the cusp. And by the year 2030, the baby boomer generation will have fully retired out of the workforce. And there's only two ways to really fill that shortfall. One, you bring in like a ton new immigration, which under Donald Trump is probably not likely. or two, you really bring women fully into the workforce. And that fills the gap by 23 million workers. And so it was economic necessity that first brought women into the workforce under Rosie the Riveter during World War II. And it will be economic necessity that fully brings us into the workforce now. And so we're really at this pivotal moment, which I think is so interesting. And we're really beginning, I think, at the beginning of what is a long and really fascinating and empowering discussion about our role at home and our role in the workforce and our role and how our voices are heard and how we wield power.
Thank you for that. I was in New York doing what's typically called as MOS, man on the street. Of course, my team, I make them call it POS, for people on the street, where you just randomly walk up to people and interview them. This is for a film I'm making about bias. And that's when I first heard the term womanist. And China, I wanted to ask you, something that I was unaware of until maybe a year ago was that people of color, women of color, did not necessarily feel included in the feminist movement of the 60s. They were sort of marginalized from that movement. And womanist, therefore, is this term that young people of color are using to say, we're part of this too. This is our, we're coming into this. And tell me your thoughts on that and how that might help mitigate unconscious bias.
So a couple of things I'll say. When I was growing up, I'm number 7 in a list of 8, 4 girls, 4 boys. And so the interesting thing that my mother identified for us very early on was to understand that there's no feminist movement for us. We have always had to work. We have always had to balance the notion of family and work. And so the notion of when we talk about equal pay, yes, that's an inclusive conversation. But the broader conversation wasn't exactly applicable by virtue of what life required by virtue of our color. So it is an interesting movement today to now say, let's look at womanists as a movement and to make sure that it is inclusive of women of every type, because ultimately there are different issues. There are many overlapping issues, but some issues are actually fundamentally different. And so the challenge is on balance, right? How do you incorporate the broader concept, the broader set of challenges, equal pay, the ability to get through the glass ceiling, and not lose the fact that for some people, there are some additional markers on the list. If women have 12 things on the list to get through the ceiling, women of color have 14. And so the trick is to not lose those other 4, because otherwise then we get left behind in that process.
Thank you. Fascinating. Maury, you are the first ever female provost at UT. And in an institution that is typically male-dominated, tell us a little bit about that journey and about maybe even some personal experiences where you've felt that there's been a little bit of attitude or bias perhaps toward you because Sure. you're a woman. And what tools did you use to mitigate that or to get beyond that?
Sure. So American higher education is a fascinating place. And while most of you in the room are not in the industry of higher ed for your professional careers, most of you probably passed through higher ed at some point. So we have an enormous impact on shaping attitudes in American culture. And when I was an undergraduate student, I went to an institution, the University of Virginia, that was a state institution that had only gone co-ed in 1970. Which is a pretty stunning thing if you think about it, right? So taxpayer-funded university, still all male and all white until about 1970, right? And so I was there in the early 80s, and by then it had very quickly become 50-50 on gender. And I thought as an undergraduate student, what's the big deal, right? You know, women are equal here. And it's only been since I've matured and looked back on that experience that I really see how completely unequal American higher education was then and remains today. So I think back to my professors And, you know, over the 40-some professors that I had while I was there, only four were women, right? And when I look at the professorate around our nation, we still, at the rank of full professor, which is the most senior rank, are still looking at fewer than 20% who are women. So if we think about, and it's an even bigger problem if we move to thinking about representation of underrepresented minorities, those are much smaller numbers, right? And so if we think about the people who are educating and who are helping to shape attitudes of our young people, we have so much work to do in that space. And so as I moved from, so I was a faculty member for 20 years and became involved in administrative positions. And I frequently, at the level of being an administrator, so I was the first woman promoted to full in my department, you know, and that was in, you know, past 2000. I mean, that's just, and oh, and by the way, my field is art history. So this is not exactly like a field where there aren't women, right? But still, the first to achieve the rank of full, when I moved into administrative positions, often the only woman walking into a room full of men. And like many of us in the room, you have to learn how to navigate those spaces, right? And how to be seen and to be noticed. And I'll just mention a couple of strategies because, of course, there are many and I want to keep this brief. One was early on learning that I had to find allies, right? And I would love to be able to tell you that those allies were other women, but there really weren't any other women for me to find as allies, right? So I had to find other men who were willing to be mentors, who were willing to be allies, who were willing to help me advise me through situations, and actually to give me opportunities, right? But the other thing I learned, and it reflects on some of what you were speaking about at the beginning, I had to learn how to sell myself. So my first strategy was just to be twice as good as anybody else. That didn't get it, right? Because there's still too many people who will overlook the most obviously qualified person. You have to learn how to sell yourself without losing who you are. And that's a really important part. You know, we all have to be authentic to who we are. And so you have to find a way to sell yourself that doesn't try to transform yourself into somebody that you're not.
Well, and that's a really, yeah, go ahead.
I want to add something here because it's really important. So, I'm going to give you a simple acronym, which I found valuable, useful to sort of hold on to, which is PI, right? Performance, it's table stakes. Working hard moves you one stair at a time. You want to move by landings, you got to do something else. And the something else is about image management, the I, right? Your brand, whatever you want it to be, comes out of your mouth, comes in what you wear, comes in what you do. It is all those aspects. And the last one, to your point, is about evangelism. Religion exists today because people keep talking about it. If you want to exist tomorrow, if you want to be relevant in your organization, you do not misunderstand. I am not talking about abject arrogance. I am talking about evangelism, being clear about what you've done, what you know, and what you can do, and making sure people who have the power to give you an opportunity understand that. If you take nothing else that comes out of my mouth over the course of this time, take that with you because it really will serve you if you give it thought.
So I love that. And I love, you know, the idea that women can be self-promoting. It's not in our nature, but we need to learn how to do it. Jay, tell me, though, a little bit about, we noticed this in the current election, women aren't so likable when we talk about ourselves. When we are self-promoting, our likability factor goes down.
That's true. I mean, so the women, and this is, women face a really unique set of challenges in running for executive office versus running for any other office, right? So when you're running for a legislative office or for a board, the sort of natural inclinations of women to be collaborators, to bring people into a circle, to find win-win scenarios actually is seen as a positive, and it helps you get elected to those particular offices. When you're running for executive office, you actually, it's the talents needed are win-loss scenarios, zero-sum games, and and being able to make decisions with very little input from others. And women are perceived to be not as strong in these categories. And so they face a capability test, a toughness test that men do not face when running for executive offices, which is why you see so few women in executive office. Less than 4.8% of Fortune 1000 CEOs are women. Only 6 of our nation's 50 governors, only 17% of our mayors, because those are executive offices. And obviously, we've never breached the ultimate glass ceiling. And so when you run for this office, you have to show you're capable and you're tough. And you have to show that you can't be emotional and have your finger on the nuclear button at that time of the month and not nuke Russia. And you have to. But it's really hard then to not cross over that line and become too tough, right? And then you're perceived as a bitch. And especially when you're running for president, you have to pass the want to have a beer with you test, right? So everyone wants to have a beer with you. And that's a really, really tough needle to thread for a lot of women to do. To be perceived as capable and likable is almost impossible. And I think you really saw that in this election. And this, you know, most of the women I interviewed for my book were, you know, they had been like two-term governors or even heads of state abroad. They said they faced the same exact thing every time when they were running. The first time around, they had to prove that they were capable. The second time around, they had to prove they were likable. Hillary, the first time around, she ran as arguably a man. She had to prove she was capable enough, ready from day one, able to take the call at 3 a.m. in the morning. This time around, people didn't question if she was capable. People questioned if she was likable and potentially not corrupt. And so it was this, you know, she ran as a grandma. She ran as, like, unequal pay. She ran as, like, arguably a woman, the first woman to run for president as a woman in the United States. And it was a very different toned campaign. And she did this to try to be likable. And it was, you know, not enough this time around. And it's an interesting, we'll have to see what happens when the next woman tries to breach that glass ceiling, if it's possible for women to do. Because, again, it's such a narrow thread for women to get.
And it seems so unfair to me because, let's be honest, how likable is Trump, you know? And so why are women... Sorry. And I don't mean to bring that politically. I'm just, when you even think about, you know, some of the slander and some of the things that he said toward women and people of color and everybody else, what's important to say here also is that women judge women more harshly, too. And I think if there's one thing that we could try to change and try to take away, and I have hope, I'm hopeful for the millennials that they are changing this, but we need to support each other more than we're doing. We absolutely have to support our fellow women.
I just want to add, that's very true that women voters particularly, they never look at a male candidate and say, he made life choices I wouldn't make, and therefore I'm not going to vote for him. But women voters always look at women candidates and say, she made life choices. She stood by her husband, you know, when he cheated on her, or whatever it is that she did. She made life choices that I would not have done, and therefore I'm not going to vote for her. They put themselves empathetically into the shoes of that candidate, and that's hard for women to overcome. And it's why you don't have this sort of automatic women's vote, right? Like, women are not just going to vote for you because you're a woman. And in fact, in many cases, it's a liability that you're a woman. You have to prove it over and over again. And why you're able to govern and capable in ways that men don't necessarily have to do with women voters.
Right, so I want to take this away from politics for a minute and back onto the workplace. Some of the things that we hear about being a woman in the workplace is, number one, your voice is not being heard, right? So Karen can make a suggestion. She might not even be right up at the table. She might be sitting one row back. Nobody really hears it. Kevin makes the same suggestion, and they're like, dude, that's brilliant. Run with it, right? So how do you handle a situation like that? I mean, I'm gonna go to Maury first, and then we're going to come to you, Chyna. I want to know, when you went through those experiences, how did you find a way to have your voice being heard?
That was a long journey, because I would say for a long time, I didn't find a way. With time, as I watched, and I realized that men had no trouble, you know, jumping right back in and claiming something that somebody else had said or making sure that they were being heard, I just learned how to do it as well, and learned how to, quite often you could take somebody's brilliant and say something along the lines of, Kevin, I'm so glad you like that suggestion of mine. And add that next nuance that Kevin didn't get, because it really wasn't Kevin's idea. And so you find that way to extrapolate on it. And sometimes you don't have to say the of mine out loud, because actually a lot of people in the room will pretty quickly pick up on, oh, wait, we did just hear that, and that was yours. So again, I think you have to learn how to do all these things and whatever is authentic to who you are and how you interact in groups.
Small things like if somebody says to you, you know, hey, Susan, would you take notes in the meeting? It's really fine to say, actually, you know what? I heard Kevin does an awesome job taking notes. Try it. Do it. Same thing with, you know, can you bring the water? Can you get some coffee? It's okay to refuse that. It's okay to refuse it. Now, if you're 22 years old, it's your first job, and here you are and you're thinking, I am so lucky to be working at Yelp or Twitter or wherever, it's really a tricky position. And I know that I often hesitate to say, you know, get out of there, find a safe workplace environment, because it's not so easy if you're 22, 23-year-old to just pick up and leave, right?
But you have to keep in mind, and part of what Maury talked about, this authenticity. So you have to bring who you are with you and leverage who you are. So I will give you an example of being 25. I was practicing law. I was a prosecutor. That prosecutor's office at the time had a history of only having one African-American prosecutor at a time. I was number two. And I wasn't from there. I literally simply sent a cover letter, had an interview, and they said, gee, you want to work here? I said, sure, why not? And then I discovered sometime into my tenure that the special assignments, the cases where, so we're all in a bullpen, we're all 25, we all just got our law degrees, we're all waiting for bar results. But special cases miraculously seem to always go to the white men in our group. So I kind of watch, and finally, because of who I am, number seven in a list of eight, if you don't speak, you don't eat, okay? So because of that, I finally go to our supervisor, and I had built for myself this brand of don't bring any, I won't bring you any, okay? So that's just the deal. But if you bring it, recognize I'm going to give it back, right? So I said to him, so I just have a question for you because I've been really confused for like a couple months now. Is it my gender or my color that is the problem? And he looked at me, and he goes, well, what do you mean? I said, well, it is really important to me to not mislabel people. So if we got a race problem, I wouldn't want to call you a sexist. I'm just saying. And if we got a sex problem, I would never want to call you a racist because it would be incorrect. I'm asking because for the last 3 months, every special assignment has gone to this one, that one, and the other one. And China and Wendy and Raponde haven't gotten an assignment. So I'm just trying to figure out what it is. We went to round robin after that and had no more problem. And so I say that to say, figure out what you bring, how you communicate, what's effective. You didn't get here yesterday. You didn't wake up born into this position. You've had some life experience growing up in your own family construct, navigating school, getting that first job at McDonald's, whatever it was that has given you some skill. Don't forget to use that when you are at work every day. Right. And doesn't matter what your position is. I would literally like have been out of law school 27 minutes when all this occurred. And so now today, fast forward 30 years, doesn't matter what seat I'm in a room. My thing is, listen, if you invite me to dinner, I'm going to eat. It's kind of that simple. And so I don't question why I'm in the room, because if you didn't want me here, I wouldn't be on the list. Right. I wouldn't be on the agenda. I wouldn't be on the invitee list. So if you've gotten invited to that meeting, to that discussion, what have you, then take your space in being there because you've already passed the one test. So don't relive it. There's no reason to retake it, right? So be there, be present, and be engaged, and call people on their crap nicely. Humor, if humor's your style, sarcasm, wit, or pure intelligence, whatever it is that works for you, feel free to use that to sort of corral and manage. because you say mitigate. I got to tell you, I say it's about managing unconscious bias. It's not about mitigation. I can't fix what happens in everybody's brain, including my own, but I can absolutely manage it. And that's the trick, is to get those tools that allow you to manage it when you encounter it.
I just want to point out the idea of allies. So the first chapter that I wrote in my book was about the women in the West Wing and how when they first came in under Obama, they had a miserable time. Nobody listened to them. They didn't get anything done. Things got so bad that by November of 2008, they had this dinner with Obama where they were basically like, this is awful. We're being completely ignored and we're not doing anything here. And he basically was like, you guys need to step it up. The men are doing what I need them to do. You guys need to step it up. And he suggested they start getting together. And they did. They started getting together. They started having dinner regularly. They didn't really know each other that well. Some are from Chicago, some New York, some California, other places, before they came to the West Wing. But they started all getting together, and then they formed friendships and bonds. And so when somebody in a room said, a woman would say one thing, and then 10 minutes later, the guy would say, wow, that's a genius point. They would be like, hey, no, Kate said that earlier. And, they'd point it out and sort of get each other's backs. And then if they were left out of meetings, they would take notes for each other. Or they would text each other, like, hey, quick, we're meeting in the Roosevelt Room. Come by now. Or they would call each other up and say, hey, did you see, that this report came through having to do with this, area that's your area. They would sort of all keep an eye out for each other, and they got each other's backs. They would give each other advice on what to wear and, how to act and whether to have drinks with this person or that person. And they would network, and it really helped. And, by the second term, they were running that place. It was a total sisterhood, and it was really, really different. So.
Oh, that's so well said. And I want to punctuate what both China and Jay just said there, because the one thing that we've heard is that it's most important to give our daughters and our sisters and our any young woman is confidence. And don't waste time thinking, how did I get here? I'm the only woman in the room. This is weird. I'm the only person of color. Take that opportunity and run with it. And believe that you're there, that you are meant to be in that room for a reason. How many people know what the female factor is? So Harvard Business Review, June 2011. I always like quoting this because, again, no offense, but when there are men in the room, they like to know that I'm not just making all this up. Harvard Business Review, June 2011, published a study that's called the female factor. And it said that regardless of the individual IQs of a group of men on a team, if you add one woman to the team, the collective IQ rises. The more women you add, the higher the IQ of that group goes. We add EQ, emotional intelligence. We add a different perspective, but we add a lot. And so any all-male team is sort of foolish not to bring a woman in for a lot of reasons, and certainly not to fill a quota, but because we actually do contribute. So remember that, own it, and use it. Maury, there was an interesting thing, I don't know how many people saw it, that went around on Twitter and on social media just I think a week ago, where a young woman named Tiffany Martinez wrote a paper, and she's in college. I think she's a doctorate or a PhD candidate. She's written a lot. And in this particular class, she wrote a paper, and at one point she said, hence, and then she went on with her sentence. And I don't know if it was the professor or the TA, that wasn't disclosed in the article, but circled it and said on it, not your words. And then put at the top of the paper, must use your own words. So somewhat accusing this young woman, Ms. Martinez, of plagiarism. And of course, she was saying, this is bias. If my last name had been Hamilton or something, he would never have questioned the fact that I used the word hence. Did you read that article?
I did not see that article, but it's not surprising. There is so much research, whether it's happening in school places, it happens on resumes that are sent in. I mean, these are places where the association of name with ability is very, very strong. Best practice in teaching and grading is you grade all your papers blind. That's certainly what I always did as a faculty member. because it's not only the bias that comes with name, it's also the bias that comes with attitude in the classroom. Right. So I can remember this was actually more often towards my male students. They would come in, they're wearing a baseball cap, they're slumping down, they've got this attitude. And I would go to "and not very smart." Right. And then I would read their papers and I would think, I had no idea that all of that was actually going on in your head. Right. When you're doing this. And so I learned early on that I needed to be able to grade all papers completely blind so that I wasn't bringing those associations, which can come from so many different things that we build up about people, and to be able to judge them. And that's why in hiring, it's really important that companies view resumes and CVs through lenses and through structures that are meant to help mitigate against bias. So name is one, right? So there are some great studies out there. You send in the exact same CV of names that sound ethnic and names that sound Anglo-Saxon, and the Anglo-Saxons get called back at, like, you know, 2 to 3 times the rate as people who have more ethnic names. But there are other biases that we build into our hiring practices that are so damaging, right? So we tend to look at a CV. We do this in higher ed, but we do it in the workplace as well. If somebody went to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, or Stanford, we automatically assume that they're the most qualified, right? Well, what we also know about Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Stanford is those are mostly kids of privilege, right? And that's not necessarily where you're going to find the talent that you need for the position you're trying to fill. And so forcing ourselves to sit down first and write out the objectives and the qualities that we're looking for in the candidates we want to hire, and only if they have to have that educational, you know, attainment, should that even be on your list. And when you start looking for other qualities and characteristics, then that, and you've agreed on that, and you get everybody on your committees to focus on that, you usually end up with a very different pool of finalist candidates than if you just go with somebody's gut. Right. And again, they go for that likability and what looks like themselves.
I want to get a sense of how many questions there might be. We have 2 microphones here in the center. You could just come up and stand behind it. But I want to make sure that we have enough time for questions. So we'll keep going on up here. Otherwise, if you do have a question and want to come to the microphone, I'll get to you really, really quickly. Let's see what I have to do. Yeah, pay equality. We want to talk about pay equality. Interesting, really interesting factor. Again, a lot of companies, Salesforce, GoDaddy, have said, enough of this. We're going to make sure that every man and every woman of the same level are going to get paid the same. Now, well, this is talked about base salary, right? But hang on, let me finish for 1 second. What's interesting about this, though, is that probably within 5 to 10 years, the gap will grow again, because women don't ask for raises as much as we should. I said this on a panel in New York City in front of all the New York City officials, and I was like, and then a couple of people stood up and saying, yeah, I want a raise, yeah, I want a raise, and the officials are looking at me like, thanks, Robin. But, you know, I mean, so, but it's a problem. We need to believe that we deserve that raise or that promotion. So that's, we're part of the problem there.
Oh, I was just going to say, Salesforce, it wasn't like they volunteered to do that. It was 2 women who forced challenged the CEO publicly to prove that he was paying women equally. And he was like, yeah, I'll take that. And then, like, he was like, oh, no, shoot, I have to actually add $3 million a year to my annual payrolls because I was not paying them equally.
Yeah, I'm actually going to interview one of the women for the film I'm making now right on that, which is fascinating. Tanya, do you want to? Okay, good.
So, as we get started, let's give these women a round of applause. Great information. Exceptional. For those of you who haven't queued up to the mics, go ahead. Now's a good time to start. I'll start with the first question. We've talked about fending off unconscious bias, but addressing it is a much more delicate issue. Seeing it in the room and making it visible so that others can learn from that. Do any of you have any particular strategies that have been effective for you?
I,
China sort of addressed this in one of her points. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, you do have to call it out. And you're going to have to do it in a way that you're comfortable doing it. But there are actually lots of ways to address that. And to just sort of say, sometimes not calling it bias helps. I think you're making an assumption there that's not backed up by the evidence, or something like mm-hmm. that, as a way to contest an assertion that somebody's made, China, that you have some other.
Yeah, I default to this concept that says a well-placed question is better than a smart answer. Mm-hmm. And so when I see bias happening in a room, yeah. sometimes it's just about asking the question. Right. I usually will say something. Now, people who know me know that the more solicitous my question is, the more I think that means you just said something really stupid. I will say, so help me understand, because I heard this and that, and I'm missing the distinction. So usually a person who has that epiphany moment in the 30 seconds, you know when it happens, because you see it right in their eyes and they go, because they realize that wasn't what they intended. Now, for the person who intended it, different conversation. But for the person where it was truly unconscious and it was unintended, usually then there's a retraction in terms of the explanation or an amplification, but it gets you to the right best place. And so I would say, don't forget the power of a really good question, because it's amazing at what it can do for folks without making you the bitch, without making you aggressive versus assertive. It's just about demonstrating, in some ways, intellect and thought along the way that sort of helps other people think differently.
For me, calling things out as you see them, particularly as a journalist, and you're seeing it happen on a national stage. And so one of the stories I ended up writing in New Hampshire during the primaries was about Hillary screaming, right? And so, you know, Bernie Sanders could yell at you for 40 minutes and you'd be like, yeah, yell at me for 40 more, right? And like, you know, Hillary Clinton would raise her voice and everyone would be like, oh my God, she's so shrill. Why is she screaming? Mom's screaming at me. This is terrible. And there was a really like adverse reaction to it that was very palpable amongst the press. You saw like Bob Woodward on Morning Joe get up and talk about, you know, she's shrill, she's screaming. A lot of male journalists said that. And the fact of the matter is, it's an unconscious bias. We are not, as a society, used to hearing powerful women raise their voices in passion. And it just gets everybody's hackles up, and there's no solution to that. Hillary's solution was to do this kind of terrible stage whisper, which to show passion, she'd be like, it's so important to me. You know? And that was like obviously not very good either. And that's just gonna take time. It's a matter of a generation getting used to hearing women yell passionately about things that inspire them, and that's just gonna take time.
Good. Thank you. All right. Now it's time to open it up to the floor. Let's start on this side. We have more people than minutes left, so let's get through as much of this as we can. So who do you have a question
for? I appreciate all the conversation on the biases that we have to be aware of to know how to mitigate or manage or however you're going to approach that. Something I'm interested in is, as women, are there unconscious biases that we have a greater proclivity to have ourselves, and that we need to be more aware of in ourselves as we go into the workplace and meetings and have these interactions?
I mean, we all have biases, right? Every one of us. And that's the problem with unconscious bias, is we're not always aware. As much as we want to sit there and say, I'm not sexist, I'm not racist, I'm not... We are, to a certain extent, whatever that we might be biased about. So it's really hard to stop and sit there. And one of the only ways that they've found that we can become more aware of our own biases is to surround ourselves with people unlike us, because they'll be honest enough to point it out, right? And that's how you learn from other people. Like, wow, I didn't realize that what I just said could come across as bias.
Can I add very quickly? There's a really interesting research project that's been going on at Harvard for many years that's called the Implicit Project. So if you Google Harvard and Implicit Bias Test, you can go out and take this yourself. And it's a really fascinating thing, a very good exercise for everybody to go through, because it will highlight some of your own implicit biases. But then it's also part of the nationwide research that's helping inform our own understanding of implicit bias. So everybody might want to try that.
I would just add that the last recession was a man session, and so a lot more men went into predominantly female fields like teaching, and it created a glass escalator effect because women are so much more used to weighing more powerfully what men say versus what women say, that these men actually advanced much more quickly than their female cohorts in this field because they were men and the women listened to them more. So just be aware of when you're listening to people, like, that you're not also, you know, listening to women and discounting their opinions and giving more weight to male opinions.
Thank you. All right, well, over here.
I just started an Austin-based office for my San Antonio-based company, and I'm supposed to hire 82 people next year. And as part of that, I'm seeking an intentionally diverse team. I'm a designer in technology space and have the benefit of being able to do blind portfolio reviews, and it's something we're going to be practicing. However, I also have, it's so important to me that I also kind of want to intentionally practice some uncommon biases. And I wanted to, obviously I'm not going to hire anybody who isn't qualified, but I wanted to hear this panel's opinion on intentionally driving diversity into your organization, even though you're acknowledging that you're practicing bias in doing so, and the potential value of it. I think that there's a lot of value in the benefits you receive from a diverse thought group.
There's absolutely no doubt that a diverse company will create products that serve a greater breadth of humanity, that your perspectives on the world are going to be more broadened. And so there's no doubt that diversity helps businesses. One of the things I would suggest is when you're writing your job description, make sure that you wordsmith that with a man, with a person of color. There are certain words that completely marginalize certain applicant pools. And so it's really important to look carefully at. I did a screening of the code film at eBay, and the senior male engineering VP said, "Hey, look, I put out a job description. I got 2,000 applicants. Less than 5% were women." And he goes, "So I'm trying." And I said, "Well, who wrote the job description?" He said, "I made personally sure that I wrote it to make sure." No, but he was well-intentioned. He was well-intentioned, right? But he's like, "I wrote it to make sure that I was in charge with exactly how to fill it." But he used words like ninja and highly competitive and, you know, words. So qualified women didn't apply as much. So I would,
I would say to you, so we've been embarking on this effort at Deloitte to improve and enhance the diversity of our own workforce. There is absolutely nothing wrong with figuring out who the best external partner is to reach a diverse candidate pool. Part of the challenge is you can't put a big billboard up on the side of the highway and say, "All black women, all black people and women come," right? You just don't. It doesn't work that way, right? So you have to use some intentional and deliberate strategies, because despite the fact you're looking for a diverse population, that diverse population is not in a monolith somewhere simply waiting for the next male, right? So you have to be intentional and deliberate to reach the groups that you're looking for. That usually takes partnering, and happy to talk about some of that later offline, in order to do that so that you get the right pool coming in the door. And then the selection process does what it does. If you put in the right structure, then you will get exactly what you're looking for. But you got to start with a pool that is, in fact, diverse enough.
It's a big challenge, yep.
All right, thanks, ladies. We'll go to the other side.
So my question stems from finding allies that Maury pointed out. And a little bit about myself. I got back into working kind of gradually, but I have a nonprofit and we bring movies to Austin. But that whole idea of coming to that point and starting what I do, I try to reach out to my allies and the friends over the years, and I realized that women are not your best allies most of your time. And that was a shock. And I'm sorry to bring it up, but how do you address that? We are a team.
Okay,
but we are not.
First, I need you to not apologize for having an opinion. It's just not necessary. We have got to stop saying "I'm sorry" about everything all the time. Okay, we just have to. The second thing is recognize we are all women, but we all don't think alike, feel alike, or look alike, or talk alike, right? So recognize that part of the judgment you have to make is whether those relationships were real or to what degree or extent they actually existed. Being friends and having a sponsor are not the same thing, right? So you may have great social relationships with folks. Do not confuse that with sponsorship. All right. Do not confuse that with coaching or mentoring. Don't confuse those three things. They are distinctly different. Sponsors are people who are going to use their chits, their power, to in fact move you forward. And that's really important to have. And what I would say is not everybody is capable of doing that, not because they don't want to, but because they frankly don't have enough position to. And others aren't interested. And so then you have to find folks who are. And that's just, you know, that's just navigating the process ultimately.
Thank you.
All right, here. Hi, I've always been very fascinated by unconscious biases, and I've prided myself in working my career through and kind of navigating those unconscious biases. But now I'm turning a corner for my life and really what's important to me. And I'm a mother of a 2.5-year-old little girl and a 4-month-old little boy. And I'm starting to look at these unconscious biases a little bit differently in the mother lens. And I know that there's a lot of mothers here. And so as we sit here and we're talking about all these things, it was, and I know, Maury, I'm a UT employee. I know that you're a mom.
Yes.
I was wondering, have you thought about as a mother, or I don't know if the rest of you are moms, I apologize. I don't apologize. How you navigate through that as a parent, and are unconscious biases able, are you able to change them from infant? Because I'm not sure, I know that there's all kinds of studies with little boys and little girls naturally doing things differently. Mm-hmm. And so I just, to navigate through that also as a mother, just open that up for discussion.
Yeah, I think that's really an interesting question. I thought it was enough to make my daughter take the garbage out and my son, you know, make the salad at dinner, thinking, you know, I am so on this. And I'll tell you that it's the subtle things that we do that influence our kids that are the most dangerous, I think. For instance, saying things like, so what's your homework in? Oh, it's calculus. Oh, God, yuck. Right? The things that we said are, I hated my math teacher, or I hated math class, or I hated any of those comments. It's the most impossible thing, I think, as a mother, especially when you have teenagers, to be neutral. And yet that's kind of what we need to be, to not inflict our own opinions and our own assumptions and our own biases on our kids. But we're the most influential factor in their lives. So watch what you say to your kids.
And I would just add that I think you can have really explicit conversations with them about all these topics. And I think if nothing else, helping them understand and begin to conceptualize places where they're seeing inequity and difference and bias. And if you point these things out and talk with them and get them thinking about it years before many of their peers are probably doing so. I think that's one of the most important things you can do.
The thing I just add here is make sure both children have a voice, because as long as they have a voice, then they will represent themselves. And at the end of the day, that's really some of the core challenge, right? Which is to make sure everybody feels empowered to have a voice and to articulate that. And my now 6 to 19-year-old son used to love to walk around when he was 3 in my shoes every day. And then he played football and basketball, and it didn't make a difference at the end of the day. So, you know, it's about making sure they know that they can speak and be heard and that they have a right to be respected for what they're going to say.
Good. All right. We are going to have time for one more question. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Michaela, and I'm here as part of IBM, so I'm in tech. And so I'm very interested in the fact that we're struggling in technology to pull more women, people of color, more diversity within technology, and I just for clarification, I am a Gen Xer with 2 millennial children. I've got a 22-year-old and a 12-year-old, and both are interested in technology. My 22-year-old is studying computer science, and she's frustrated as all get out because she's seeing articles and information saying, when you put your resume out there, don't put your name on it. Put your initials and your last name only. She's getting messages from others that are telling her, you know, she's been told, you know, well, you can't go into this kind of discipline, but you can go into this kind of discipline because that's more for girls. How do we get past the point? Because when I was growing up, I had a legacy of, you know, the feminist movement and ERA. And I remember going with my mom to all of these events and things like that. And I feel like we've swung backwards to some extent. And I'm just wondering, how do we get to a point where we move forward? We're giving our girls the messages that, you know, STEM is relevant to them without also negating some of those other disciplines like art history or, you know, some other areas at the same time, and just attract those within those industries and fix it, I guess, in education. I'm just trying to figure out what's the path forward, and then what do I tell my girls?
Well, I will just start by saying that if your daughter's studying computer science, she's on the right track, because there are over 500,000 unfilled computer science related jobs in the U.S. alone right now. And by the year 2020, that number will be over 1 million. So they're looking for computer scientists, whether you're irregardless of color and gender. So I would say she's on that, and to go out there proudly with her degree and look for jobs.
Do you think she should not put her name on the thing? Like, half of me goes, put your name on there. Make
see,
sure
I
out
tend
there.
To disagree with that. It's sort of how I feel, like, stand up and put your name proudly on something. Will it be subject to bias? Probably yes. But can we try to push through those barriers? We're not going to do it by putting our initials on everything all the time, are we?
I just want to... just to also on a... So the public sector has really led the way with critical mass and bringing more women into the workforce, and that's true for computer science as well. So while the Silicon Valley is still an area where women have struggled to break through, in Washington, the U.S. Digital Service and almost all of like the digital side of what's being done is more than half women. And so you see a lot of women who've self-selected out of Silicon Valley. Like, for example, the designer who helped build the whole back end to Amazon systems. She was so in demand in Silicon Valley, she didn't want to work in Silicon Valley anymore. She hated the culture there. She's now rebuilding the VA systems, the Veterans Affairs system. So, I mean, there's a lot of women who are in tech in Washington because they've self-selected out of Silicon Valley.
Okay. And as China said before, you have to be excellent at what you do. Mm-hmm. You have to be excellent at what you do. And unfortunately, women and people of color have to be even more excellent at what they do because it's the way that we are seen. But I just say keep pushing. We're not going to get anywhere if we don't.
At the end of the day, your daughter's going to have to do what she's comfortable with. And so I am a full believer in navigate the path in any way you can to get to where you want to go. Yeah. And that's about what your own comfort zone is at the end of the day. So if putting her initials doesn't feel disingenuous to her, put your initials. If using her name she thinks is important and matters because that's part of who she is, then use your name. There will be some opportunities you get and some you won't. But that also will happen if you happen to be 6 feet tall. It'll also happen if you happen to weigh 300 pounds. It'll also happen, you know, depending on what school you've gone to. So the trade-off here is about how you want to move through your path, and that's what she'll have to decide eventually.
So we have unfortunately run out of time, but I have two options. You can stalk this panel all the way down to the ballroom for lunch. Or you can meet up with Jay personally, where she'll be signing copies of her book, Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way America Works, downstairs in the exhibit hall. Let's give these ladies one more round of applause. Thank you, everyone. Have a great conference.